So each of us builds our own world from our stories, our personal perceptions, our emotions, and values. Oh, I wanted to say, in Puma's culture, they have that definition of reality that the dictionary gave us, because they absolutely believe that everyone's reality is reality. But when you tell me your reality, the first rule is don't manipulate me with lies. Tell me your reality true, and I will believe it, even if I don't accept it as mine. So you honor each other's realities, but you do demand integrity in the sharing of realities. So I believe that a valid scientific model of reality has to be a model of our experience of reality through our human consciousness, because none of us ever have any experiences outside our consciousness. Even people in comas are still conscious. Even if they can't have physical movement experiences and things, they very often hear everything that's going on around them. And that implies that consciousness has to be fundamental somehow in a valid scientific model of the universe. Now, Vedic science figured this out a long time ago and taught cosmic consciousness as the deepest reality. And then we had the Taoists, the Kodadama, many indigenous cultures, all getting it, but it's only now coming into Western science. And we have had some Western scientists, there's always been a smattering of them, who have gotten the living universe concept. And George Wald was one of them, assuming the existence of creative mind throughout biological evolution. Now we have ways of showing that experimentally. But in my model, I like to think that if you see cosmic consciousness, multiverse, emptiness creating whatever you, however you make your picture of it, and then your local human consciousness, your own experience, is one perspective on that. Has anyone found a limit to their own mind yet? You start from one point in the universe, you here, but your mind can expand, and you notice in science, every time they tell you the universe is bigger, you update your mental model. Oh, yeah, okay, it's bigger. You can always accommodate the new. Microworld now is big in new discoveries, and we adapt to this as we go. So our local consciousness can coexist with the whole of the universe. And the way you link the two is through the inside, not through the outside perception of science, Western science, but through the inner perceptions of Eastern science. And another way that I like to use to talk about this is using the metaphor of a keyboard. And if you use the metaphor of the keyboard, you can see that, and you say matter is down in the low vibration keys. That's where science starts out, because matter, you can make instruments within the world of matter that can measure that world of matter. And then they discovered electromagnetic energy about a century ago, and that was considered very woo-woo, new-agey stuff, until they were able to really measure it. And now we're up to the zero-point energy field within science. But meanwhile, the religious people started at the other end of the keyboard, in consciousness, in mind, in spirit, and saw the universe from that perspective while science was seeing it from the other perspective. And what's happening now is that we're undoing the historical barriers that were set up on this keyboard so that we can see how our whole universe that we all live in might be functioning. So it's a nice time. You know, just going back to that a minute, Einstein, of course, showed how the music can be transposed from the mid-range to the low range and back, matter into energy and so forth. So now the big transforms that we're seeing are consciousness into energy, into matter. That's the next level of understanding. And physics is describing a universe of self-organizing energy now. So perhaps we're starting to get away from the old model. But a lot of neuroscientists are still trying to squeeze consciousness out of the brain. They're still trying to start with matter to generate consciousness rather than seeing consciousness as generating matter. It's that 180-degree turn that most of the Western PhD scientists I meet in venues like this have made. Fred Allen Wolf, you heard, and you get all the scientists that were in What the Bleep, and this graphic comes from that movie, What the Bleep. So do the brain neurons generate the consciousness, or is the brain some kind of an interface device between the physical perceptual stimuli coming into us and our internal consciousness? These are the questions that are now legitimate to ask. And I mentioned earlier this book, Kinship with All Life, and my guru, J. Allen Boone, and I wanted to show you his guru's picture. This is Strongheart. Strongheart was the first movie star dog in Hollywood. And Boone, by humbling himself to become the pupil of this dog when he was caring for it for 6 weeks, was able to enter into the deep communion that's in nature everywhere and have hours of philosophical conversations every day, not as man and dog talking to each other, but as he says, the universe talking us to each other. And the first time I went into the Amazon with a beautiful long-haired Indian, I was still naive enough to say, can you teach me to talk to the plants and animals? And he said, oh, shut up and listen, Elizabeth. It's not yours to initiate a conversation that's been going on as long as this forest has been here. It's yours to try to hear it. And so we dropped this birthright of deep communion when we made the decision to pretend we're separate from nature and be in charge of it and only accept the measurable as our reality. Very interesting exercise, but it's come to an end nicely, right? We're now moving on. So, for the first time in history, we have to choose ourselves, each of us, whether we think the universe is mechanical or alive. Because academia is largely still on that side, and the people are moving largely over to this side. So that's what makes this such a very interesting transitional time in history. When I visited China in 1974, they kept saying, science is the summation of the knowledge of the people. And I really didn't understand what on earth they were talking about for some time. But when they sent their professors out into the countryside to learn from peasants, it was a very serious exercise because the scientists discovered that peasants had made discoveries about plant breeding and things that were considered theoretically impossible. And it was only when they took the actual work the people had discovered and the successes they had had back to the laboratory to formalize it and explain why it worked and stuff that it became part of the science. So they meant that very seriously, and it's quite an interesting concept. I think it's happening here now in our world that the people are jumping ahead of the academic scientists. And so we each have to figure out our world of experience and try to build our own story of how things work. So science itself now is in the process of changing its story of how things are more dramatically than during the Copernican Revolution. There's a new book out on Giordano Bruno. I can't remember the name of it now, but the most recent one published about him that's very interesting in showing why the church and science both condemned Bruno, who was, of course, burned at the stake, because he had an omnicentric universe. He was way ahead already of the Copernican model. He's appropriate for today when we have non-locality coming up in physics and we know that every point in the universe is connected to every other point, that this really is an omnicentric universe. You are at the center of your universe, each of us, omnicentric. So we now can ask these questions about, can life really come from non-life? Can we get intelligence from non-intelligence, consciousness from non-consciousness? You see, when you make the shift of consciousness as primary, everything gets much easier. You don't have to use magic to explain how life can come from non-life. So this invention of non-life is in the Western trajectory of science. And no other trajectory in human culture has it, because non-life is something that never was alive. It apparently comes to life, and science has been in a long process of trying to give us complex explanations of how that can happen. But we also know now that even at the bacterial level, there's very intelligent reorganization of itself when necessary. I'll get to that in a minute. But I asked then, what if Galileo had used these newfangled lenses of his day to look down into a drop of pond water instead of up at the heavens through a telescope? Might biology have become the leading science rather than physics? Seeing all these squiggly things in that unknown micro world, might they then have projected that onto the macro world? And eventually, perhaps, psychology will become the fundamental science if it's all consciousness. We didn't have a real definition of life in biology until a couple of decades ago, when two Chilean biologists, Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela, gave us the definition called autopoiesis, a good Greek word, autopoiesi, meaning self-creation, same word that poetry comes from. A poem is a self-writing story if it's autopoietic. If a poet is writing the poem, it's allopoietic in my own terminology. So this definition tells us, autopoiesis, it tells us that a living entity continually creates itself, self-organizes in relation to its environment. Now, this is a beautiful way of distinguishing organism from mechanism, because mechanism has to be created from the outside, like a story that's written or a poem that's written. It's allopoietic. Notice that this definition of biology doesn't say anything about reproductive capacity or size. The old way of defining life was just to memorize a list of attributes of life, right? Like irritability, motility, growth, reproduction, that kind of thing. Well, autopoiesis is simply about self-creation, continual self-creation. Now, when you walk away from your computer, you hope it does not change while you're gone, not one iota, because they're not noted for changing in positive mutational ways that improve them in your absence. But when you walk away from a friend, you better hope that friend keeps changing. Otherwise, they're not alive anymore, right? So it's a nice way of distinguishing organism and mechanism. An autopoietic entity repairs itself and does all of these wonderful things, reinvents itself as it goes, changes in order to keep itself the same, and yet evolves. So it's a wonderful definition, and it means we can now ask these big questions. What about these great whirlpool galaxies? When I sat on my Greek island trying to figure out what's the simplest autopoietic entity, I came up with a vortex. A whirlpool in water is constantly exchanging matter through itself while holding form, just as you and I. And a vortex, if you connect the bottom to the top and swing it into three dimensions, is a what? No, take the spiral, take the bottom, connect it back to the top, and now swing it around into three dimensions, and you get a torus, a donut shape, right? What are you? A torus, mathematically, is an object with one hole through it all the way. A teacup is a torus because you can push the cup around, there's no hole through it, and the handle is the only hole in the object. You are a torus with one hole through the middle. And what do? You keep taking in matter and energy and transforming yourself and evolving and letting out what you don't need, just like a whirlpool. Isn't that interesting? And of course, in England, before Einstein, the smoke ring universe was the prevailing model of physics. And Lord Kelvin came into the Royal Academy in Edinburgh with a box that he blew smoke rings out of to show that the torus is the only self-contained geometric object that will float itself in space. All interesting, but I must get on. Are galaxies like organs in our universe? How much time do I have? Somewhere here it's supposed to tell me. Is there a clock here for me? Anyway, I ask these questions, and in collaboration with my friends Nassim Haramein and Elizabeth Rauscher, who have, to me, the most elegant unified field theory, radiation and gravity in their theory is in perfect balance. So while the universe indeed expands infinitely when you look through telescopes, it is also contracting infinitely at every point in the universe, so that you have black-white holes everywhere. Every object in the universe that we see through telescopes is a black-white hole, and we see the radiation. And even Stephen Hawking has now acknowledged that black holes can radiate, making Nassim very happy, because he doesn't have any physics degrees or any other college degrees for that matter. And the math of his system is exquisite. Now, he was calling gravity centropy, while I was saying entropy must be balanced by syntropy. And it was, that's what brought us together, was that these two words that we had come to were so much alike, even sounded alike. And I also saw that as, in biological terms, anabolism and catabolism, the buildup and the breakdown, the recycling. Gravity is a generoactive force that recycles the radiation, if you like. So we have a universe in this new kind of balance theory, and I wager that whoever gets the Nobel Prize for the unified field theory, it will have to be a story of nature in balance, not a one-way running down nature. Now, let's get to biology, evolution. Creationism versus Darwinism is hot again in the United States. It had died out after the Kansas School Board controversy, and now with President Bush saying he thought intelligent design should be taught in the schools, it is back in the news again everywhere. And so a few years ago, when I was asked to speak in a Midwestern city, a reporter called me up in advance and said, you know, I don't think too many people will come out for an evolution biologist here. This is Bible Belt country. And I said, well, just write in the newspaper that a creationist evolution biologist is coming and see if they don't come out to see what that is, because it's not supposed to be possible, right? And it worked. A lot of people came, and they bought all the books. And in fact, they bought the only book available there was A Walk Through Time, and I had been forbidden by the editor of that publishing company to ever use the word consciousness, because they had a science reputation to uphold. However, I substituted intelligence for consciousness and got away with it. So it's a pretty good leading edge view of evolution, in which nature is intelligent from the get-go. And I figured, you know, I have to adjust my vocabulary to my audience. And while I'm on that, I'd like to gift you a word to use in the future, because I noticed in our circles yesterday that everyone who referred to what had been going on as a process called it discussion. And discussion is a word about, like, percussion. It's a smashing word. It's a fragmenting word. And so I would urge you all to change your word discussion to dialogue, which is a wonderful Greek word meaning dialogos, through the word. And it's about coming together through the word rather than breaking things into analytic pieces in order to discuss. So try saying dialogue from now on. Anyway, consciousness is, and self-organizing living systems are wildly creative, so why not call myself a creationist evolution biologist? And when I talk with fundamentalists, the difference between us reduces to their God is allopoietic and mine is autopoietic. And that's easier to talk about than evolution here and Darwinism there. And I agree with most of their critiques of Darwinism. And in fact, you know, when Bush said intelligent design should be taught in the schools, I could just about get behind that. And my scientific friend said, aren't you furious that the intelligent design people are using you as a spokesman in a television show that apparently is now being shown? And I looked at the transcript and I said, they haven't misquoted me. So I don't mind being over in their camp for a while talking about this. I mean, like, what do we get so uptight about? Why doesn't our evolutionary theory reflect these ideas? And I'm saying to understand that, we need to do a little history lesson here. Now, back when Magellan circumnavigated the globe, or his people did at least, he didn't quite make it around himself, this established that the Earth's territories were finite and ownable. This was a very big step for humanity. And out of that came commerce. And Columbus's voyage started commerce between Europe and the New World, including the slave trade from Africa. We're now starting to move the resources of the world and the products of the world around the entire planet for the first time. When Pizarro got to the Inca Empire, it was 2,500 miles long. It had very sophisticated architecture and ideas and social organization and plumbing and waterworks, all that kind of thing. So what did they do with it? When they found it, of course, whoop, let me go back there a minute, come back. Over 24 tons of exquisite treasure were collected for Atahualpa's ransom. You probably all know that story. And then they garroted him. Now, all of these master works were melted down into gold and silver bricks and taken to Europe. And this had a lot to do with the financing of the early Industrial Revolution. Now, the industrial entrepreneurs took up science because they recognized its value for engineering machinery. The church had rejected science. The big power alliance in the world had been between church and state, and it shifts historically to industry and science. And that is what's running our world largely today. So this means that the mechanistic worldview of science replaces the religious creation story. That's just in a very small nutshell how it happened, with scientists gaining the status of a priesthood that tells you how things are. Now, in 1600, Queen Elizabeth founds the East India Company, giving it monopoly rights for bringing goods, plundering India, basically, to get ahead of the Portuguese. And the East India Company then becomes part of the multinational of its day. There were eight East India Companies, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the French, the British, the Swedish. There were all these branches of East India Company. And it is this multinational that the American colonists revolted against with the Tea Party, right? And King George is over there. You can see him to my right, your left, on the wall. So we get the Boston Tea Party, and then, interesting, this is the British East India Company flag. This picture is Betsy Ross sewing a circle of stars over the British cross. And this is, of course, the United States flag today. So not too many people in America realize that they adopted the flag of the multinational that they were rebelling against as their own flag. So that's just an interesting little piece of history there. Now, the East India Company's chief economist was Thomas Malthus. How many of you remember the Malthusian theory from school? Okay, looks like we can use a little bit of a refresher course. He studied the world and concluded that the world was going to end soon because the human population was going to overwhelm food production. And that justified the us-or-them mentality of we better get what we can while we can. Not only is the whole universe running down, but we're going to run out of resources on the planet. So this is how it gets going. Now, Darwin adopts Malthus's theory of competitive struggle in scarcity as his theory of evolution. Malthus was a family friend of the Darwins. Darwin read Malthus's famous essay, and in exploring the bounties of nature, the marvels of nature, finding them all around the world, and of course also marvels of humanity, but they were seen as very uncivilized people, He then adopts Malthus's theory, giving us our belief in endless scarcity and fierce competition for resources, a humanity doomed permanently to win-lose economics and warfare. And just so that you know I'm not making this up, here's the quote from The Origin of Species. "Nothing is easier than to admit the truth of the universal struggle for life, or more difficult than constantly to bear this conclusion in mind. Yet unless it be thoroughly ingrained in the mind, I'm convinced that the whole economy of nature, with every fact on distribution, rarity, abundance, extinction, and variation, will be dimly seen or quite misunderstood." It is the doctrine of Malthus applied with manifold force to the whole animal and vegetable kingdoms. How many of you knew that? You see, it isn't taught. We don't have a historical context for our own scientific theories. So science rests on a foundation of beliefs, and these beliefs color the theories. And it has never been proven that this is a mechanical universe or a non-living or an accidental universe. It's not provable. These are fundamental assumptions. And I'm often accused of using metaphors that are pretty, but what have they to do with science? And there is no science without metaphor. The business of science, as Stuart Kaufman once said, is choosing the appropriate metaphors. And our metaphors change as our technology evolves, so that the old Freudian plumbing system brain evolved into a telephone switchboard and later a computer and then a holographic camera device, and now it's a parallel processor. These are all metaphors for nature, because only nature is there to inspire us to study, to try to talk about and analyze, and we can only do it in what's familiar to us. So we use metaphors everywhere. It's just that I like to teach people to use organic metaphors rather than mechanical ones. But that is often classed by scientists as anthropomorphism, projecting human qualities onto nature, which is a heresy in graduate school. But mechanomorphism is required of you. And mechanomorphism, I thought, was kind of second-hand anthropomorphism, since Anthropos, man had invented machinery. Was that really the way the whole shebang works? Who knows? Anyway, to understand living systems and evolution, I abstracted two basic patterns that helped me really understand things. One is a cycle of evolution that begins with some unity, which individuates. And as soon as you get individuation, you get tension and conflict. Perfectly natural, and Darwin was absolutely right that this is part of nature. Okay? He got the first half of the cycle, this far. But what happens then? If they don't bump each other off at this phase, they start to negotiate some of these conflicts, and they actually resolve them, sometimes forming cooperative ventures that can build unities at entirely new levels, scale of size. This happened in evolution, for example, when bacteria, which were the only life forms of Earth for 2 billion years, having the planet to themselves, rearranging the continents, changing the atmosphere, battling it out, competing with each other, working out all kinds of strategies and all kinds of technologies in the process, including the first worldwide web of DNA information exchange. And then suddenly we have a nucleated cell in which the ancient bacteria show up as parts. And Lynn Margulis and her work with Jim Lovelock and the whole Gaia hypothesis, they figured out, there had been earlier Russian research as well, that this had happened because a process of invading cells for food when it was scarce by high-tech bacteria who had electric motors and things could invade the more sluggish ones and eat out their resources in a long phase of what I call bacterial imperialism. And then somehow, because these colonies died, When the resources were eaten up, they figured out that a division of labor could form an ongoing, lasting community. And it was the biggest leap in evolution, in biological evolution on this planet. Because after that, everything else that evolves beyond bacteria, which can still stay as bacteria because of their wonderful DNA internet, we get everything else that's visible, the plants, the animals, the fungi, growing from these nucleated cells. We ourselves are made of up to 100 trillion of them. Now, everything in our natural world, I maintain, is at some stage of this cycle. So nature shows us this dynamic cycle of competition followed by cooperation. Now, if you look at ecology, you will find that they talk about type 1 ecosystems as being made up of pioneer species. I call them young species. They call them pioneer species. They take all the resources they can get, all the territory they can get, they multiply as fast as possible and are very competitive. Then you move to a type 3 ecosystem, and you find that they're all sharing resources and territory and ensuring the life of other species and are way more cooperative. And if you ask them, where do those guys come from? Or, you know, they say, well, it's a different kind of species. They replace the ones in the type 1 ecosystem. What's a type 2? Well, it's kind of mixed, made of both kinds. Is it possible that there's something going on here like maturation? I mean, the refusal to see this maturation curve to me is like aliens coming to the planet and seeing babies and grown-ups and old white-haired people getting decrepit and saying there are at least three kinds of two-leggeds on this planet, right? They're different species. So once we get this, it will immediately update, I hope, the whole Darwinian theory, because we have to complete the cycle in order to see it all. Just as physics has to balance entropy with centropy or syntropy, biology has to balance competition with cooperation. And then we will have a more complete biology. Now, holons in holarchy, holarchy was mentioned yesterday, is the other concept. The cycle, and this is way easier even, nothing but embeddedness that we're talking about as holarchy. So you can have a single-cell creature living within a multi-celled creature within a local ecosystem that's part of a larger ecosystem. Or you might have a nice self-organizing storm, toroidal, living within a self-organizing planet, living within a self-organizing galaxy. You get the idea. It's just embeddedness in nature. Now, let's look once more at the cycle simultaneously. How can this cycle play out simultaneously? Put it together with holarchy, and what do you get? In your body, there is self-interest at every level of your body's holarchy, from molecules to cells to organ systems. And because every level is expressing its self-interest, you get individuation, you've got tension and conflict, which constantly has to be resolved to keep the whole system working. This is, to me, the essence of how it all works. It's not evolution either by Darwin competition among individuals or by the altruist people in evolution theory who say, no, it's not competition among individuals, it's competition among species for ecological niches. Or then you get the blind watchmaker Dawkins version, no, it's self-interest among the molecules trying to express themselves in the gene pool. They are all right, but only together. Self-interest at every level drives negotiations and cooperation. That's the secret of nature's success. So suppose your body's economy were run like the current world economy. We'll call the heart-lung system the northern industrial organs and give them the power to give them ownership over the raw material blood cells, which are formed in bone marrow all over the body, and permit them to mine it and take it up to the heart-lung system, where the blood is purified and oxygen is added to make the final blood product. And then the heart distribution center will announce the body price for blood today and see who will buy it and ship it to the organs that can afford it. That's basically how we're running our economy. Could our bodies stay healthy in that kind of economic system? Can our world? No. See, it's very easy when you see the whole picture. You see exactly why things happen. Why do you see hunger crises and crises of overproduction at the same time in the newspaper? How do you explain that? It's all very simple when you see how nature works and what system we've evolved, how it differs from the natural systems, then we can see what we need to do. And the Earth as a whole is functioning as a single intelligent being, like a gigantic cell evolving smaller cells within it. Remember that at every generation, we are reduced back to a single cell. That's the basic life form. Multicelled creaturehood is kind of gravy, frosting on the cake. Planet doesn't need it to survive. After every critical time on the planet, you find afterwards in the fossil record that there are batches of new species showing up at the same time, as if the Earth, with its language of DNA pervading all life forms, can reorganize itself, can make different kinds of creatures to meet different crises. And that's another natural secret, is that you don't change the things that work well. You change the things that don't work. You become radically creative when you have crises. Crisis is the opportunity for evolution. No creature is a thing in itself apart from others. The Earth is a giant cell. We now have more than half a century of evidence, a lot of it coming from here in England with people like Brian Goodwin and May Wan Ho, stuff showing that evolution happens when DNA intelligently reorganizes itself in response to crises. We know now that genomes repair mutations and put new genes into service. And if you want one essential argument against the Darwinian evolutionists, consider that if you're going to base evolution on mutations, that mutation, which probably happened as an accident of reproduction, must survive in the organism until it can reproduce and pass it on. Otherwise, no evolution from that mutation. Now, the editor genes that repair the genome when something goes wrong will have to know which mutation to keep, because most of them are not fortuitous. Most of them are not beneficial. And if they weren't cleaned up, then we wouldn't function at all. Our genome would quickly deteriorate. The genome has to know what's supposed to be, what books are supposed to be in the library, and which ones have been damaged and need to be replaced or repaired. And so you'd have to, interestingly, the metaphor of editor gene is an organic metaphor implying intelligence. But scientists put quotes often around metaphors that they want to discount. So they use living metaphors, saying galaxies reproduce themselves or something like that, and then put it in quotes, meaning, I don't really need that, right? Why use metaphors that you don't really mean, right? So they use these organic metaphors and then deny them because nature is mechanical and can't be intelligent. Very interesting. But so we know that evolution proceeds through intelligent dialogue between DNA and environmental stressors. And so I call myself a post-Darwinian evolution biologist because life is too intelligent to proceed by accident. It's not that mutations don't happen, but that's not the way evolution works. As to say, our DNA knows what it's doing to your genetic, and I'm putting into quote here, engineers, because engineers are supposed to be able to improve the systems that they work in, and thus far we have no evidence that genetic engineering has made any improvements. So I think Darwinian theory misleads us because evolution is intelligent rather than being based on accidents, and because nature learns to create abundance from scarcity, and because ecosystems are co-creative, not linear phenomena. And it's dangerous because it has justified the perception of nature as non-intelligent mechanism, chaining children to machines for the sake of profits. Nowadays, we lock women into factories in Asia for the same purposes. It justified the Holocaust. That's the us versus them, the survival of the fittest idea, the dog-eat-dog idea, and dogs don't eat dogs. And now we have the tyranny of the quarterly bottom line. Now, I have heard the CEO of a wildly growing bank on the East Coast of America get up at a Spirit in Business conference, talk about how spiritual his company is, and then say, and we are sustainable because we have knocked out most of our competition. And when I said, excuse me, sir, would you mind repeating your definition of sustainability? I'm not sure I heard it correctly. He repeated it and said, madam, you must know this is a dog-eat-dog world. Now, this good-hearted man thought he was standing on good science, that this is the way the world is, that this is the way business has to be run, that this is what sustainability is insofar as it's possible. So it's vitally important that because you can't have Darwinism without social Darwinism, you can't have mechanism without social mechanism, because science is the priesthood of our culture, and we believe what it says and we do what it says. So we need to update science very badly. We need a new story of evolution that tells us that, for example, nature is a whole earth phenomenon, that it's in intelligent dialogue, that it's a learning organization. It's abundant and balanced and resourceful in crisis. You know, in Darwin's day, I'll wager everything got recycled, but it was so natural to do that that they didn't think of it as a process that he could see in nature. Although the ancient Greeks saw recycling in nature and the Indians. It's process as a maturation cycle. As I said before, nature doesn't do either ors, but very conservative with what works, very radical with what doesn't work. Why do we think it's so hard to weave 6 billion people into one global family when a single human body is made of up to 100 trillion cells? And each one of those cells is as complex as a large human city. So beware the notion that simpler things are, that small things are simpler. Our model of fractals now helps us to understand how you can keep opening up a point and finding equal complexity at all levels. And of course, the hot new science is nanotechnology. Every one of our cells has about 30,000 recycling centers in it, just to keep your proteins healthy. Grok that complexity if you can. We have trouble grokking the complexity of the universe, the vastness, the number of elements in it. We have equal problems in our own microworld that we carry around understanding this. So cells have had more time to evolve than multi-celled creatures. They're bound to be more sophisticated, if you like. And these 50 years of lab evidence showing us that DNA reorganizes in response to stress that I just mentioned, do you know how much DNA you have in your body? If you could string together all the DNA molecules in your whole body, every one of your cells, according to the Human Genome Project, has about 2 meters. Multiply that by 100 trillion and stick all those pieces end to end and fly a jet plane along your own personal DNA. Do you know how long it would take to get to the end of it? Anybody have a guess? It's big. It's about 23,000 years from before, from BC times, you'd still be flying. Grok that. And admire your own body. This is a precious, precious vehicle we inhabit. Oops, that's a mechanical metaphor. I was thinking of it in the Vedic sense, though. How much DNA is there in soil, in organic soil, about the volume or weight of your body? There's just as much DNA as there is in you folks. So all those microbes add up to as much DNA as you have in you, and worms and insects and all that is there. So it's a precious, precious commodity, the living soil, that we haven't done very well caring for. And so this, the sum of my fractal biology is from multi-creatured cells. That's when the big cell was evolved from individual bacteria. We went to multi-celled creatures, and now we're doing a kind of new multi-creatured superorganism, if you like, or whatever we want to call it. And I think that's what globalization is, that it's the process of the human family coming together as all species who survived long times in evolution had to do to move out of their hostile, competitive, juvenile phase into the mature phase. And we can see that global cooperation is already happening in the arts, in our ability to travel the world, in our communications through the internet, our ability to change money across all cultures and languages, and we have international space stations, we have more frequent world parliaments of religion and United Religions Initiative, and we have the United Nations experiment, and we have science cooperating. These are all evidence that we're perfectly capable of doing this cooperative human species thing. And what happened with the demonstrations around the world against the invasion in Iraq and things like that, where we had millions of people saying the old way of making war, of attacking each other, doesn't fly for us anymore. We want a world that works for everybody. We want a cooperative world. And we want to see negotiated self-interest at all levels. So there's no way for a World Trade Organization to function if it's going to dictate to the other levels. If it's going to build a world economy at the expense of local economies, that is like trying to run your body at the expense of your cells. It doesn't work. All levels in a natural living systems holarchy have to have the power. So we've seen ourselves at a distance, and I ask, how clearly have we really seen ourselves? And what would other beings in the universe think of us as a species? If they're looking at us, would they even perceive us as an intelligent species? Is it intelligent to destroy the rainforests that are pumping the weather, taking the moist ocean air up into the high stratosphere and carrying it to the poles and having it come down again as snow and rain, and with the sun, the solar driver of this cycle, the forests are a very critical link in it. Is it intelligent to cause global warming? And if you don't think it's happening, here's a 1979 map, and notice the Siberian coast, the western end of the ice shelf there, and look now what has happened to it. And we now know that this melting of the permafrost, I'll go back once more, and you can see how the melt is creeping up onto Greenland too. So it's a bit hard to deny when we have the pictures like that. The stone, you know, Greenland is the big ice pack we have to worry about, and as you all know, because here they talk about it on the news, Amsterdam and London are very vulnerable, and also if the Gulf Stream is killed by the melting ice, which makes the water colder and is going to depress the Gulf Stream, then there, another mini ice age could happen in Europe. Do you ever wonder in the Renaissance why everybody's dressed up to the ears in clothes in Italy? All those paintings were painted during the mini ice age. Right? Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. Are we preparing adequately for the end of the oil age? Is it intelligent to let wildcats and whales and so many other species be extinguished by one? Where's our respect and care for the community of life on which we depend? So we've got to have this kind of holarchy of the individual, the community, the species, the ecosystem, the planet, all negotiating. And notice that the triple bottom line is when you get a business to be accountable not only to people, community, but to nature, and that gives you a triple bottom line, not just profits, but planet and people as well. So you can see economics very nicely in this model too. One example from the indigenous community is the Maori concept of manaakitanga, which is respect for the conscious mind of the individual, the whanau, the family, the extended whanau, the hapu, the village, the iwi, and our global community. And Mexican grandma once said to me, anyone who knows how to run a household knows how to run a world. So women who have had experience with living systems understand that the same principles of organization apply at all levels. Economy and ecology are both made from the Greek word ekos, or household. One is the logos of the household. Ecology is the rule of the household, whereas economy is, I mean, the logos, the organization of the household, and economy is the ekos plus nomos, is the rule of the household. How do you separate the organization of the household from its self-rule? You can't separate economy and ecology, as our politicians try to do. Anyway, indigenous people get that, and there are creative economics that lie in all people everywhere. So let me close with one little example. When I was in China in 74, I went to a place called Red Flag Canal, a valley that had been so dry that the old people were drinking kerosene to commit suicide so they wouldn't take up any more food or water. And the young people decided to build a water system to bring water from a river 70 kilometers across the Dayang Mountains from this village. And they proposed this formally, and government engineers were sent out to see whether this is feasible. They marched the mountains and said, no way is this possible. This is a crazy harebrained scheme, and you're forbidden to even try it because it'll be a waste of energy and you need to be doing something else. And as soon as the engineers went away, they started. They smelted iron from their red, dry earth in mud brick ovens. They made pickaxes. They made shovels. They made chisels and hammers, and they got the people to start to chip rocks into blocks. And they swung from ropes off the sides of these barren cliffs with their pickaxes to dig in a toehold. And they made homemade dynamite, and they blasted tunnels. And they built aqueducts bigger than anything I've seen in Italy, in either ancient Rome or modern day times. And they brought that water 70 kilometers across the mountain range. And about a year ago, I said, this place must still be known. And I looked it up on the internet, and this is what it looks like now. It is green. And what do the captions say besides Red Flag Canal, today's Great Wall, youth made river in heaven? It says, one of the greatest of these senseless endeavors of China was the construction of Red Flag Canal. To divert water to a poor region, peasants spent years constructing a channel through mountains and alongside steep hillsides using the most primitive tools. Senseless endeavor. To me, they proved that it does not take money to cause development. And I've recently come in contact with a man named John McMillan who does this personally. He has greened any desert they have handed him within 5 years to feed people adequately. He takes children off garbage heaps and feeds them a slurry of tilapia fish and vegetables and brings them to life and makes them into productive adults. He's raised at least 20 such children. There are people on the planet who show that it can be done just through will, motivation, and good fellowship. So Red Flag Canal is now a scenic ecological tourism area with research and all kinds of things going on there. I have to end. We need a world that works for all. And as a Greek citizen, I was enormously proud of the Olympic, the pre-Olympic 4-hour show. How many of you saw it on television? Wasn't that the greatest show on earth? So amazing, with the DNA rising through the ceiling at the end and all that. It was just amazing artistry. And in the good old ancient Greek tradition of flying people on stage and stuff, and not one glitch. So it's our evolutionary mandate to create sustainable global economics with heart and truly become a global family. Nature's on our side. And the way it works is the same way as a caterpillar metamorphosis into a butterfly. Crisis is opportunity in the chrysalis. Imaginal cells arise in the chrysalis after the caterpillar has eaten hundreds of times its weight every day, bloating itself and finally hanging itself up and turning its skin into a hardened chrysalis. And these imaginal cells that then begin to arise in its body are attacked by its immune system. And biologists did not know why this was until very recently, when they worked out that the genome of the butterfly is a completely different genome than that of the caterpillar, carried through evolution. So metamorphosis is about the old and new coexisting for a while. We're changing our metaphor of the turning point to the metaphor of metamorphosis, realizing that the old and new coexist. You are all imaginal cells. You are here changing the world. That's why you came, because it's the most exciting time in the life of this planet, certainly for humanity. The planet doesn't need us. We need the planet. And we need to learn from the planet in humble ways again, whether it's from dogs or caterpillars or whatever. All the role modeling is there. So we just need to ask ourselves, are we ready to become a mature species? Can we know the Earth as alive and intelligent again and meet each other as facets of oneness to create living, mature economies, sharing the Earth's resources with each other and other species, and truly knowing ourselves as spirit having human experience? And I promised you I'd end with a Rumi quote. Here it is. Why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open? Say it with me. Why do we stay in prison when the door is so wide open?
I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good.
Show has helped you get out of your box. Its URL is unwelcomeguesses.net/529. Next week I'll be broadcasting an episode on prophecies of doom and social collapse. If you've got opinions on this matter, you're welcome to register them at unwelcomeguesses.net/collapse. If you do so within the next 2 days, then I can include them in the show, thanks to everybody who's already contributed. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.